going to read the Bible. You'll find what I'll be reading on the inside of your information sheets. It's from Matthew chapter 16. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, you are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his glory."
Thanks, Andrew. There is a reason why it's almost always better to talk about Jesus than to talk about Christianity. Now, I know it is true in the West and it is true in lots of the world. Christianity is a system, a set of ideas and things you do, especially things you do. And you can do them as intensely or as mildly as you like. You know, I will be there for the Lord's Supper. I will bring my child for baptism. I will be there for church. I will wear a cross or a fish or a something on a chain. And Christianity talks about believing things, and I think I know what that is. You know, I will think that they are true. That's believing, is it? Thinking something's true. That's not hard to do. There is a God. I will think that is true. He created the world. I will think that is true. It's so undemanding and mild that I can have it as a kind of hobby. I can even have just parts of it and still call it Christianity if I want to. Here in the suburbs, there is... here in the suburbs where so much Christianity is so middle class, I can get confused between which are my Christian ideas and which are just my middle class ideas. You know, the treasure that I yearn for of a nice house in the suburbs, a good marriage, my kids in private schools, a granite worktop in my kitchen. Is that Christian treasure? Or am I getting mixed up with middle-class treasure? If I'm in the subcontinent, I can say, my family are Christians, so I must be too. I will be there at church for the bread and wine. I can be in Egypt under severe threat for identifying myself as a Christian. But my Christianity can still be a mild thing that means I think certain things are true and I wear certain clothes. Christianity can be a kind of hobby that I get out from time to time. You know, like my train set. Jesus, though, Jesus is not a collection of things that you do. Jesus is a person who we cannot mess around with. We cannot treat him like a hobby. Look at him here. Jesus in Matthew 16 is Jesus of the story so far. This is the Jesus who faced the tempter in chapter 3 and never gave in. This is the Jesus who told Peter and the others, follow me, and they put everything down and went with him. This is the Jesus who touched the leper and the leper was healed, who sent the demons away just by talking to them. This is the Jesus who calmed the storm and made the blind see. This is the Jesus who makes such an impression on his time and place that they are all asking, who is he? The disciples in chapter 8, what sort of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? John the Baptist in chapter 11, are you the one who is to come? King Herod in chapter 14, oh, this is John the Baptist, he's been raised from the dead. And then in chapter 16, Jesus heads out of Galilee with his disciples up to the little Gentile town of Caesarea Philippi. And the man who calmed the storm and walked on the waves and healed the sick and made the mute speak, he puts the question to the people who know him best. Verse 13. Who do people say the Son of Man is? Now, they know, like we know, that Son of Man is one of Jesus' favourite ways of talking about himself. So there's no mystery there. So they tell Jesus all the rumours. Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And reading that straight away, we know that ancient Galilee is just like Western Sydney. You know, it doesn't matter how stupid an idea is, there will always be someone who is prepared to say it. John the Baptist is dead. Herod killed him. Elijah was whisked up to heaven 800 years before, and Malachi the prophet spoke in cryptic terms about Elijah coming back before the day of the Lord. But then in chapter 11, Jesus has dared to suggest that John the Baptist has now fulfilled that by being a kind of Elijah. And then some say Jeremiah. Well, there were some funny Jewish legends about Jeremiah coming back one day as well. And in a way, it wouldn't be too bad if you could say that Jesus was one of the prophets. Prophets are good. Everyone thinks prophets are good. Prophets usually say cryptic things in really cryptic ways. The German worm shall be crowned and the prince of brass will be buried. For 150 years he shall remain in anguish and subjection, and then for 300 more he shall sit enthroned. Well, that's the sort of thing that prophets say. The world loves a good prophet. It is the answer the Quran gives about Jesus. He is a prophet. And it sounds really respectful. If we ran the same question in Western Sydney, we would get very similar answers. Who is this man? One of the prophets. But here and now we have other ways of saying prophet. We might get words like he's a philosopher, or a healer, or a teacher, or a guru. And any of those might be a good starting point for thinking about Jesus. But the man who calms the storm, can you really see him fitting in to any of those boxes? He calms the storm, so he's a good teacher. He calms the storm, so he's a philosopher. None of those categories will do justice to this Jesus. And none of those categories from the first century are really going to do it either. So Jesus narrows the question down in verse 15. But who do you say that I am? Now, you know, you feel trapped like an insect on a pin when someone asks a question like as bluntly as that. And then good old Peter comes out with, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And at this point, of course, we congratulate ourselves that we knew the correct answer all the time, because that's what we would have said. But hold on there. I mean, of course, we knew the answer all along. Matthew told us in the first verse of his book that Jesus is the Christ, and in the second chapter that he is the Son of God. So we have had 15 chapters to get used to the idea by this time. And anyway, we belong to a civilization that has been using the word Christ as though it is Jesus' family name for 2,000 years. Of course, we knew the answer. But what do we do with that answer? See, Jesus is very pleased with Peter. He congratulates Peter enormously in verse 17. "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah," and all that. And see just how much Peter is saying. Jesus from Nazareth, the man standing in front of Peter while he's talking. Peter is saying that this man is the king in the line of David, the one that the prophets look forward to. He's saying that Jesus is the good shepherd in the line of David that the prophet Ezekiel looked forward to. He's saying that Jesus is the wonderful counselor, the mighty God that Isaiah looked forward to. He's saying that Jesus is the Son of God who will rule the nations that David looked forward to. That Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. So what does that mean for Peter and the others, and for us? Well, Jesus goes on to say what it means for us. But before he gets there, he does the rest of congratulating Peter. And this is the bit where the people in the Middle Ages have given us a minefield that we need to clear slightly. Verse 18. "I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Well, that's entirely clear too, isn't it? Is it? Is Jesus saying, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church," and Peter has the power of the keys, and he passes them on to Linus, and Linus passes them to Anacletus, and Anacletus passes them on to Clement, and Clement passes them down the line via Pope John the 23rd, the pirate pope in 1410 AD, and finally to Pope Francis in the 21st century. Is that what Jesus is talking about? The thing that makes Protestants a little nervous about these verses, because people who love having popes have used these verses so many times to say, this is it. This is the bit where Jesus establishes Peter and everyone who comes in line after him with the power of the keys. Mind, the New Testament doesn't give any hint of lines of succession coming down from Peter. Or for that matter, the New Testament doesn't give a hint of any lines of succession. You know, think about it. Peter was married. What happened to Peter's kids? If it was all about successors to Peter, surely they'd be the ones to get a look in. Or for that matter, Jesus' brothers, James, Judas, Joseph, they were all descended from the line of King David. But once Jesus has come, the whole line of David thing is complete. There is absolutely no interest from the early Christians in people who are descended from David via James or Judas or Joseph or the others. The New Testament has no interest in lines of succession after Jesus. So if it's not a line of people who come after Peter, is it Peter himself then? Does verse 18 mean, like 1,000 comic strips, that when you turn up at the pearly gates, there will be Peter with his big visitor's book and a set of keys to let you in, because he has the keys to the kingdom of heaven? Oh, but in verse 18, Jesus says, on this rock he will build his church. But what is church at this stage of the story? God's assembled people. Like in the Old Testament, God's people gathered together, like the rest of the New Testament for that matter. Never a building, not an organisation, not an institution, and definitely not a hierarchy of priests and things. So the assembly that Jesus is gathering together, he is building on this rock. Is that Peter? Well, here it is. Peter and rock are masculine and feminine of the same word. It's a good old metaphor. In the Old Testament, God is sometimes the rock. In Peter's own writings, Jesus is sometimes the rock. And here, in his great and glorious moment of understanding, Peter gets to be a rock. A bit like in Paul's letters, where he compares Peter and the others to pillars, or in another place, to foundations. Here, Peter gets to be a rock. And how is he the rock on which Christ will build his assembled people? Well, look back at verse 16. What has Peter just done? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. We knew because we had read the story so far. But Peter is the first. He is the absolute first. So of course he's the rock. He is the foundation stone. He is the pillar. He is the concrete slab being poured. But thanks to God making it clear to him, he's got it. He knows Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Don't detract from how great that is for Peter for a moment. And those keys to the kingdom of heaven that Jesus gives him, those keys that enable him to do things here that have consequences in heaven. It's a metaphor, isn't it? A word picture. Jesus uses a similar word picture in Luke chapter 11 when he's telling off Pharisees and the ancient Jewish lawyers. In Luke, Jesus says, "Woe to you, lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you have hindered those who were entering." See, those lawyers, those experts in the Old Testament, had a key. They could have taught people the truth about God and life. They could have opened up the doors. But instead, they chose to make themselves masters of the secrets, to keep it all complicated, to make their own rules, to keep people out. But what does Peter do? What does Peter do with "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God"? Well, go down the track, just 47 days after Jesus is raised from the dead, and what do we find Peter doing? We find him standing up in Jerusalem and telling a crowd of people, "Let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified." And the people were cut to the heart and said, "What shall we do?" And Peter said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ, for the forgiveness of your sins." You see what Peter's up to? He is doing something with consequences in eternity. He is opening the door for people on the kingdom of heaven. He is unlocking the truth about Jesus for them. He's opening the way for them to go in. And you go a few pages further into the book of Acts, and it's not just Peter doing that, it's all the disciples. And then more and more and more people. But Peter is the first. And go a few more pages in Matthew from here, and we find Jesus saying similar things to the rest of the disciples. And he says here to Peter. But, well, in chapter 18, they all get a piece of "Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven." But Peter is the first, and no one can take that from him. But then what happens? It is chapter 16 out of 28 chapters. Peter at last, with the help of God himself, has got the message. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So what now? From here to Jesus' resurrection. Verse 21. From that time Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. In one sentence, it's all there. Up till now, it's been, "Who is this man?" Now that the answer is on the table, Jesus takes the disciples to the next stage. The Messiah will go to Jerusalem. He will suffer and die. Then he'll be raised again. Just why that will happen, Jesus does not make clear yet. Chapter 20 will make it clear. The Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many. Or chapter 26, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. But the answer was always there in Isaiah the prophet, the servant of the Lord who would come and suffer on behalf of his people to win them forgiveness, to justify them, to stand in their place in front of God's judgment. The one who would come and give himself to save others. And now that it's out that he is the Christ, Jesus starts to lay it on the disciples that he is the servant of the Lord. Well, poor old Peter is okay with the Christ bit, but this is just too terrible. And don't you feel for him here? I mean, he's just had his great moment. You are rock. I will build my assembly on this rock. But then Peter is so appalled by what Jesus says. No! This cannot happen. This must not happen. Verse 22, far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you. And we go from blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, to get behind me, Satan. Now, Jesus is not suggesting that poor Peter is inhabited by demons, but the next bit gives the sense of it. You are a hindrance to me. In their language and their way of using words, a Satan is not just the name for the devil. A Satan is an opponent or even a prosecuting barrister. Peter is being the opponent here, whether he intends to or not. He's getting in the way of what Jesus needs to do to carry through his mission, to save people from judgment, to win forgiveness, to set things up so that Peter can be the first to open the gates and let people stream in. Jesus has to go and suffer and die in Jerusalem. But if that's what the Christ does, if that's what Jesus does, what are the options for disciples? If Jesus has to walk that road, do disciples sit in a comfy chair, do church from time to time, have a religious hobby, think that certain things are true, go to the Lord's Supper, wear a cross on a chain, but mostly get on with their lives? Verse 24. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. So there you go, we can get away with wearing a cross on a chain. No. Whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. But what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? You see what's going on here? This isn't follow me when it's convenient, or follow me if you don't happen to be booked up for lunch this week. This is all or nothing. This isn't give me the spare bits of your life when you think you can spare them, or consider my teachings and use the ones that you like a bit. This is whoever would save his life will lose it. Now watch out for the context here. Back in verse 21, it was he must go to Jerusalem. This is pre-cross. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem to certain death. For these disciples, to follow him is to walk along the road behind him. To follow him. The Gospels do not use follow in the sense of to follow Jesus' teaching or to follow Jesus as a kind of philosopher or even to follow Jesus by believing in him. The Gospels don't use follow as a metaphor or a figure of speech in that way. You can check it out later on. Follow, as in to follow Jesus in the New Testament, is always very literal. You might follow other things in other ways in the New Testament, but follow Jesus is walking along behind him on the road. Not a metaphorical road, but the dirt track that leads to Jerusalem. And if they're going to follow him on that road, they are going to certain death as well. They may as well pick up that heavy wooden beam that a condemned prisoner has to put on their shoulder and march along behind him. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. To be with Jesus is to be absolutely with him. But we know how the story goes, don't we? It's a crude fact of history that Peter and the others don't. They follow Jesus so far, and then they pike out. That night in the garden, they run off to save their skins. Good old Peter, who shines so bright here, lies about ever having known Jesus to get himself off the hook. When Jesus goes the last part of this road, he goes alone. None of them follow him. But what about afterward? What about after Jesus has been raised to life? What about after Jesus has won the forgiveness that lets these fickle disciples back in? What about then? Well, then, in one way, verse 24 no longer applies. Never again. After the resurrection, Jesus has finished the journey to Jerusalem. Never again will anyone follow Jesus. So are we safe and in the clear? We don't have to follow him to Jerusalem. We don't have to put a cross on our shoulder. We don't have to give our life totally over to him. We can do religion as a hobby. We can wear Christian jewelry. We can get our kids done. We can get on with our lives. We can treat Jesus like a train set that we get out and tinker with from time to time. Is Jesus still so all or nothing after his death and resurrection? Well, take Peter, rock man, key man. Go to the writings of Peter himself. What does Peter say it means for people to belong to Jesus after his death and resurrection? Well, 1 Peter 1, Peter talks about the outcome of your faith, your salvation. So, after the resurrection, the deal isn't walking along behind Jesus along the road. It is trusting in him to be saved. But that trusting in him to be saved. Is that a mild part-time hobby or what? 1 Peter 1. Be holy in all your conduct. 1 Peter 1. Love one another earnestly from a pure heart. 1 Peter 2. Abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against you. 1 Peter 4. Live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. And we get the impression that Jesus' words here in Matthew about picking up the cross and following Jesus were very deeply imprinted in Peter's mind when he wrote, Christ also suffered. We'll go to the next one, thanks, Roland. Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might walk in his steps. See, in one way, verse 24 is over. The journey to Jerusalem is over. Jesus went. He suffered and died just as he said. And none of these disciples followed him all that way. And that's how it was always going to be. There's no following him anymore. But if he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, there is still trusting him and living for him. And if he's the Christ, the Son of the living God, that is no hobby. That is a full-time, wholehearted occupation. When Jesus quoted the most important commandment as loving God with all your heart and all your mind and all your strength, he wasn't kidding. Our time, our energy, our imagination, our hard-earned cash, who we choose to love. If we're going to trust Jesus and live for him, the whole lot is within his orbit. All or nothing. But don't insult him by making a part-time religious thing out of him. Don't belittle him by pretending to be his and then saying, except for my time, except for my energy, except for my imagination, except for my hard-earned cash. He has no claim on that. And I won't let him tell me who I will choose to love. All or nothing. Dangerous question, really, isn't it? When Jesus says, who do you say I am? When you answer, all kinds of things follow. You can play safe and hedge and say, I don't really know. But by the time we are up to chapter 16, Matthew has told us enough that we really do know. We cannot pretend and say one of the prophets. That cuts Jesus down a peg or two and we don't have to worry about him as much. But if we say, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, beware. Because if he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, he is the one who has gone all the way for us to suffering and death and resurrection. And if he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then he deserves our absolute trust and our absolute allegiance. Nothing less than that. He is the Son of God himself. So who do you say the Son of Man is?